Talk Back with Gary Knoll, Sundays at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to be exploring several issues in depth. No guest, instead, everything about health and healing and living a longer, more dynamic and vital life. We're going to explore, for example, programming genes to extend their lifespan. Now, many of us have been trying to do that for a long time. In fact, my entire adult life as a scientist working in anti-aging medicine and 30 of these years at the Institute of Applied Biology, we have a lot of knowledge about what can slow down the aging process. But this takes you beyond all that. This is from Charles Platt, Life Extension. So you're going to get a real insight into that. Then, for all of you who care about your eyes, macular degeneration, cataracts, glaucoma, an interesting discovery about nutrients, and that will be from an in-depth article, Life Extension. Then, 7 Reasons America's Mental Health Industry is a Threat to Our Sanity by Bruce Levine from Alternet. The latest on why that polish on your cucumber and apples and other fruits and vegetables is not good for you, even if it comes from a so-called organic store. The latest on that. Needless to say, we'll be taking calls throughout our program, but not just yet. All about health, all about healing. Starting right now. Now, first up, I'm concerned that Americans are not doing enough exercise. In fact, far from it. We should be exercising a lot more than what we are. The latest research from Archives of Neurology shows that those people who exercise at the highest level of intensity as they grow older reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. But those who do the least exercise substantially increase the risk of Alzheimer's. Now, before you get to Alzheimer's, you have dementia. And before dementia, you have memory loss. So right across the board, from memory loss and dementia and Alzheimer's, lack of exercise. My suggestion, 1 hour of aerobic intense exercise. So if you're going to ride a bike, put it in the 7th gear, the hardest gear, and keep it there. If you're going to do spinning, put that pressure up to the greatest resistance. Versa climbing, cross-country skiing, the same. That's where you get your benefit. By the way, those of you who want to watch this program, while we're still in our small studio, because that's changing shortly, we'll be going to our large studio in about 2 weeks. You'll find it very interesting, because I wanted to be able to show what a non-commercial program could look like if it competed in style with Fox or ABC or CNN. I think you'll find it interesting what we've done. In any case, you can go to GaryKnoll.com to watch. So, exercise, the more you do, the longer you live, the healthier are your cells. Now, a lot of people are still allowing their children, sometimes even encouraging them by bathing them, those sugary drinks, not a good idea. Because not only do they adversely affect the child's health, including in contributing to adult diabetes, but they also end up causing the child a lot more diseases. But if you are a woman and you drink a sugary drink while you're pregnant, your child is going to end up having a weight problem. Quote, babies who were breastfed longest and drank few or no sugary beverages were half as likely to be obese as kids who weren't and who consumed the most sugary drinks. This is especially true because it was done with Hispanic children in Southern California. This is published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So if a mother is healthy, what she is giving through her breast milk is healthy. If a mother is toxic, what she's giving through her breast milk is toxic. If a child is raised and breastfed and then not given sugary drinks, they're going to live a longer life, be healthier. If a child is raised on sugary drinks, they're going to be sick. It's just that simple. So, very important. Now, I've done a lot of work within the Latino and the African-American communities on the incidence of diabetes, obesity, heart disease, high blood pressure. In fact, probably in the neighborhood of 65% of all the people attending our workshops, our health support groups, come from minority communities. You have been led to believe that it's genetic. I will challenge that and say it is not genetic. And we will show you on an upcoming series of programs, because right now, in fact, it started today, I'm leading a group of individuals, minority individuals, from multiple backgrounds and different ages, different professions, who are all suffering from the same diseases, high blood pressure, heart problems, and obesity. And over 6 weeks, I'm determined, with their cooperation, of course, to bring down their blood pressure to normal, to reduce all the underlying causes of heart disease, so that they can live a vital and healthy life. This will challenge, if I am successful, and they are successful, this will challenge the idea that it's in the genes. Because you know where that's going. If it's in the genes, then they're going to want to test everyone. Every minority will want to be tested, not want to be tested, insist to being tested at some point, so they can, quote, be given the drugs that can prevent a disease. So let's say if you're completely healthy and you're a minority, the direction the pharmaceutical companies are going to go is put into place statutes or laws at the state or federal level insisting that because you are vulnerable because of your genes to a particular type or series of diseases, you must be tested so they can determine, we're going to save your life. And by putting on these meds proactively, preventatively. Well, no one has ever benefited by being put on chemotherapy to prevent cancer. And no one has benefited by being put on these high blood pressure medications, if they don't have it, to prevent blood pressure. And no one's ever benefited by being given Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, or any other psychiatric drug to prevent any kind of psychiatric disorder. It's all about the money. They're just looking at you and a whole race as an income stream. So you'll have a chance to follow a large group of people making lifestyle modifications, no medicines. And in 6 weeks now, I'll bring them on this program. And you can see for yourself. They're different people. Next up, omega-3 fatty acids could prevent and treat nerve damage. Now, this is from the University of London, published in the Journal of Neuroscience. And here's what it says. Research from Queen Mary University of London suggests that the omega-3 fatty acids, which are found in fish oil, by the way, they're also found in flaxseed oil, have the potential to protect nerves from injury and help them regenerate. When nerves are damaged because of an accident or injury, patients experience pain, weakness, and muscle paralysis, which can leave them disabled, and recovery is poor. Now, a new study published just this week in the Journal of Neuroscience shows that the omega-3 fatty acids, which are non-toxic, can play a significant role in speeding recovery from nerve injury. Now, we have what are called peripheral nerve cells, and the peripheral nerve cells are the nerves which transmit signals between the brain and the spinal cord and the rest of the body. These nerves have the ability to regenerate, but despite advances in surgical techniques, patients usually only have fair recovery when their injury is minor. Omega-3 fatty acids are vital for the body's normal growth and development and have been widely researched for their health benefits. And because your body cannot manufacture omega-3 fatty acids, you have to consume it from your food. So the researchers first looked at isolated nerve cells. They simulated the type of damage caused by accident or injury, and by stretching the cells or depriving the cells of adequate oxygen. But when they gave the omega-3 fatty acids, there was substantial recovery from sciatic nerve damage much more quickly, more fully, and that their muscles were less likely to waste away from nerve damage. So this is all positive on what we can do. So if you have any form of nerve damage, or if you suffer from multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's, you definitely want to be taking omega-3 fatty acids twice a day, 1,500 milligrams. From the International Journal of Food Safety, it says, when you increase your dietary fiber, you decrease all diseases. Let me quote this. Quote, we should all be eating more dietary fiber to improve our health. The team of scientists looked at research conducted into dietary fiber during the last 10 years, and they came across multiple studies that showed that intestinal gas and loose stools and all forms of digestive problems were substantially reversed or prevented when there was high fiber foods. And dietary fiber, by the way, it's also called roughage, is the general term of the non-digestible parts of the fruits and vegetables that we eat. Now, there are two types. There's soluble and there's insoluble. Soluble, that's your prebiotic and ficus fiber. This is, and by the way, a great example of that would be blueberries and oats. Oatmeal, especially the steel-cut oatmeal, takes a little longer to cook. And you don't cook it at a high flame. In fact, if you really want to do it right, you bring water to a boil, then turn off the water so it's no longer boiling. Then you put in there, a half a cup of steel-cut oatmeal. It's also called Scottish oatmeal or Irish oatmeal. It's a whole little grain. And then I put 1 tablespoon of coconut, raw organic coconut oil, in and stir it around. Now, when you do that, two things happen. First, anything that you cook that has coconut oil in the water coats the grain of rice or millet, or in this case oatmeal, and protects it from overheating. Secondly, this oil, along with macadamia nut oil and mustard seed oil, are the three oils that you should only use in cooking because they're heat resistant way up until over 400 degrees, which means that they're really healthy oils to work with. And therefore, you get much nicer cooked rice. It doesn't clump. Anyhow, then you get your oatmeal. And then along the way, you can put in there some chia seed or chia meal. That's really good for you. Great source of fiber. Really helps you if you want to cleanse and detoxify your bowel. Just 1 teaspoon is all that's necessary. If you were to juice some apples and then take the pulp of 2 or 3 juiced apples and throw that into that oatmeal and stir it around, and then put some raw organic unheated honey, then you have an absolutely delicious meal. Now, if you really want to go a little bit, let's say you have some digestive problems or your immune system's a little weak, or you might be coming down with a cold or flu, then throw in about 1/8 teaspoon of cinnamon powder and the same amount of anise and a little bit of fennel. Now, you put all that together in your hot oatmeal, you have such a phenomenally healthy way of starting your day. The fiber, the protein, the essential fatty acids, all that working on your behalf. And that can help prevent diabetes. And this study shows that, quote, this is from the lead scientist, says that Research has shown, quote, that modern food habits have led to an increase in the incidence of obesity, cardiovascular disease, and type 2 diabetes. And there is growing evidence, substantial amount, that any developing nation that uses the Western, that means American, diet of highly processed foods, high in sugars and saturated fats, beef and dairy products, and low in dietary fibers is displacing more traditional options. And that leads to disease. By including the fiber, you reduce disease, you reduce cholesterol, you reduce attenuating blood glucose, you maintain a healthier gastrointestinal system, and you make calcium more bioavailable and your immune function better. All that because of quality in the fiber. Now, this is an article that is very good, a little on the long side, but I'd rather give you more information than less. And this is one of those classroom on the air moments. And this comes from Clint Richardson from realityblogger.wordpress. It's called Dude, That Isn't Wax on Your Apple. So listen up, because even people in many health food stores, not the more ethical health food stores, not those small health food stores that really care about the quality of organic produce and locally grown, I would look more carefully at the big Whole Foods when it comes to waxing everything. Quote, fancy yourself a vegetarian or vegan? Think that label that says, quote, organically grown, unquote, has anything to do with the packaging, storage, and transport of that product to stores? What if I told you that cow, pig, and chicken collagen is now used in place of wax on your fruits and vegetables, among many other things much worse than you can probably imagine? And what if I told you, with as most atrocities that happen nowadays, that this is all proved by the FDA. Since the early 12th century, there has been a tradition of applying wax onto the skins of fruits and vegetables for longer storage life. Today, that tradition is being carried on with a whole new generation of chemicals and compounds that are genetically designed to accomplish the same goal. But in these modern times, the health and well-being of the consumer of that apple is not necessarily the goal of this unnatural inorganic process. Bottom line, your produce could be being dipped and sprayed with an experimental host of holy horrors in the name of food safety and longer shelf life. Prepare yourself to be shocked and amazed that our federal agency, the FDA, that is designed to protect us, is allowing these dangerous and unhealthy practices to be perpetrated on an unwitting public, all in the name of profits. Now, and then it goes into this. There's a, for example, he shows the link on the FDA website entitled Chapter 6, Microbiological Safety of Controlled Modified Atmospheric Packaging of Fresh Cut Produce Analysis and Evaluation. And then it goes in, wow, that sounds so wonderfully official and scientific, doesn't it? So what are those, quote, preventative control measures as referred to in this report? Well, for our purposes, since these measures are actually edible, let's explore what the FDA approves for our fruits and vegetables to be dipped in and sprayed with for our own safety. And then it goes into the use of modified atmospheric packaging and controlled atmospheric packaging for the preservation of fresh produce. And over the past 20 years, quote, there has been an enormous increase in demand for fresh fruits and vegetable products that has required the industry to develop new and improved methods for maintaining food quality and extending shelf life. One of the areas of research has shown promise and a success is that modified atmospheric packaging, or MAP, M-A-P, this technique involves either actively or passively controlling or modifying the atmosphere surrounding the product within a package made of various types or combinations of films. In North America, one of the first applicants of this technology for fresh-cut produce was introduced by McDonald's in 1995, which used MAP of lettuce and bulk-sized packages to distribute to the product to their retail outlets. A modified atmosphere can be defined as one that is created by altering the normal composition of air, 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, 0.3% carbon dioxide and trace of noble gases to provide an optimal atmosphere for increasing long storage life. And this can be achieved by controlling the gases. And then this creates film. And there are different types of films that they can put on your fruits and vegetables. And then it lists what the FDA considers an edible biodegradable coatings are used in this smart, what's called smart film technology, where film is used as a coating and applied directly on the food. The use of this on fresh cut produce is major in your major markets. And then it goes through all the chemicals that are allowed in this film, including polyethylene glycol, and then plasticizers, dispersants, additives to increase the plasticity or fluidity of a material. And the dominant applications are for plastics, especially polyvinyl chloride or PVC. The properties of other materials are also improved when blended polymerizers, including concrete, clays, and related products. The worldwide market for this is in the millions of tons. Now, they also have phthalates, and I'm looking at a page here that must have 60 different chemicals. And then it lists the different kind of foods that they're put on, like melons, bananas, avocados, papaya, mango, pineapple, apples, oranges. And then it shows you, for example, Fresh Seal is a planet polymer technology and a patented coating that slows the ripening process by controlling the O2 and CO2 and water vapor that goes out of a product. And then they're using it on sliced apples, sliced carrots, sliced peppers, sliced onions, and sliced lettuce, pears, avocados. And this is a polysaccharide-based coating using cellulose derivatives as film coaters. Now, I won't go through any more of this. Let me just put this in perspective, historical perspective. Because I was fortunate as a young kid to spend a lot of time on my great aunt's farm. Unfortunately, of all my family, which was a humongous family on my mother and father's side, no one liked or seemed to like my Aunt Myrtle. Why? Because first she was a strict disciplinarian. She was very self-sufficient. She did her own carpentry, plumbing, masonry, electrical work. She ran a tractor. She farmed vigorously. What they forget is that when I'd say, oh, I'm going over, you know, to Aunt Myrtle, said, why? My brothers wouldn't go. Because you worked. She would be up in a tree shaking an apple tree, and I'd be down below, and all these apples would be dropping out of it. She was only, I think, 88 at the time she was doing this. Now, of course, when you're watching someone do this, and during the Great Depression, it was her farm in Little Hocking, Ohio, that so many of my aunts and uncles lived on and were able to eat and learn rules of morality and ethics, a strong work ethic, and she was very compassionate. My Aunt Virginia once told me that that one evening there wasn't a whole lot of food, and that morning they'd given half of their food to homeless people when a compassionate spiritual train conductor would stop a train for 3 minutes. They could only stop for 3 minutes because if the train was not on time, the conductor could be held accountable, and the trains didn't have but minutes, and they would know a longer route who would be a nice person to stop and give something, give juice, water, bread, some clothing to hobos. And each morning, my mother and her sisters, five sisters and four brothers, will get down to the train, and on picnic tables there'd be some whatever they had. If it was a stew, they'd have stew in cups. If it was a blanket that someone had made, a quilt, there'd be a quilt there. And then there would always be going around the neighbors and find out what they were going to throw away, and then they'd bring it over, and my aunt Myrtle and Uncle Johnny would fix it and then take it down there and give it to people who had nothing. And so my aunt was, my Aunt Virginia was complaining to my Aunt Myrtle, you know, gee whiz, there's not a whole lot here for dinner. And she says, you're correct, because we believe that you cannot sit to a large meal and look in the eye of someone who has no meal. Now think of that. Think of how profound that statement is. That how can I feel good about what I'm eating, knowing that there are children who have nothing? That's what she came from. That was her character. And I could see where some of my aunts and uncles, you know, had a whole lot of that and didn't want any more. But I'll tell you a little story that goes on to that. Near the end of the Depression, and remember, it was only the Second World War that got us out of that Depression. That same Aunt Virginia became, she was the oldest of her sisters. She went to work in the Parkersburg National Bank. And there was a time when the bank manager came in and says, here are some home foreclosures, and, you know, you'll have to go out and talk with these people and let them know that we're going to foreclose on your home. And my aunt, because of the upbringing she had, said to the bank manager, no, I'm not, nor are you. He said, but we have to. She said, no, we don't. She says, stop for a moment. You're asking me to go out and tell people that we're going to take their home, and these are the same people who sit with us in church on Sunday? Would Jesus have told the people, you're too poor to sit with me? You're too poor for me to help? And she said, if you demand me to do this, I will quit. I will not do this. And she didn't. And as a result, they didn't have their homes foreclosed on. I don't, and my Aunt Virginia, was who I thought the world of, said, she would not have known and to do it, nor would she have the character and strength to do that had it not been for this Aunt Myrtle. So anyhow, there I am out there, and all my cousins, not one would go out there, because they didn't want to do all this work. They didn't want to get their hands down there. And but let me explain her farm. She had hundreds of things, I'm guesstimating, growing. She had all these nut trees. She had at least 40 different types of apples growing. And some of these had been growing a long time before she was born. There was so many varieties. There were at least five varieties of pears. And then she had a big barn, and downstairs in the barn, you go down about 8 feet, there was all this brick, and it'd be a big room, and it was cold. It was about 55 to 58 degrees, and that's where all these barrels were. And these barrels had potatoes, and sweet potatoes and yams, and apples, all different types. And anything that she didn't want to go bad, this was the root cellar. And there were tons of barrels. And then I would help her. We'd cut apples into thin little slices and run them through a fish line and hang them in the attic of the barn. And 5 days later, come back and take them off because they'd be dried and put them in a keg. And then in the summertime, you'd cut peaches, take the pit out, and then put them on what looked like a screen with muslin cloth on the top to keep the flies off of it. And 3 or 4 days later, you come back, and it'd be dry. And you put those in. And I remember in just one summer, there must have been at least 40 different types of fruit that were dried that way. Then she had a little house that was the cheese house. And she'd milk the cows, she'd milk the goats, and then she'd make cheeses, and then she would coat it in beeswax. But she would also blend in the beeswax, and I never knew this at the time, why it was important, bee propolis that came from the bees' hives, and that was a natural antibiotic, and then she'd date it. And at one time, she had so many hundreds and hundreds of 5 and 10 pound cheeses hanging that she would take them to the people she knew were having a hard time, and she would give them as gifts. And so hundreds of people ate because of this one woman, and most times she did all this herself. Could you imagine that? I'd be out there and there. She'd be in there working on the engine of a tractor. And she showed me all about how to plant a particular, like a particular green and let it go over winter, because that would be plowed under in the spring and that would give She said, that's food for the soil. She's Gary Michael. She's never grow the same thing twice in a row. You got to rest the soil. And then you got to feed the soil. As a result, her soil was extremely rich and never had a dust bowl there because it never eroded. Little lessons you learn in life. And I remember that she would take the apples, and she says, now normally an apple will last about 6 months and still be crisp and fresh if you put it in a cooler downstairs. But she would take this mister, and it was like a mister they used for bees, and she would mist this beeswax on it and give it a little thin coating on it. It would make it last a year. She was also the first person who told me, you don't have to harvest the root vegetables. Let them go in the ground. I said, but it's wintertime. She's young. They'll still be there in the spring. Everyone else just harvested everything. You take everything out of the ground. No, you could let it go. So anyhow, now we come back to this. Let me tell you what my belief is from my experience. And I had the first certified organic farm that I'm aware of in New York and the first co-op, the High Food Co-op. I started a long time ago. And so today I'm a certified organic farmer, some of you know, and beekeeper. And so I work with plants every moment I get. And then I photograph this and film it and show people how to do different things to become more self-sufficient. And even if you have plenty of money, it's still joyful to be able to grow something and go out and harvest something and eat it. In fact, there's some pictures of what I harvested for one morning. I flew in to my home, and for 2 days, I was on the road 82 days. And so 2 days I took as a break, and I flew in, and I went out one morning, and I picked what would be a bushel basket of different fruits. I think there was 15 or 16 different types of fruits just off the vines. And then I took a picture of it and I put it up my website and said, see, can you guess which foods these are? No one's got it right yet. No one's named all the different varieties. And imagine how joyful that is. What kind of a spiritual experience that is to be able to go out in the morning and harvest something that's organic and natural, no chemicals, you did yourself. Now, the small health food store owners, this is what they're doing. The food co-ops are doing this. The farmers market is doing this. They're getting locally grown produce, harvested in the morning. Now, when you harvest it in the morning, the sun isn't up, and you immediately dip it in cold water, ice water, and spin it. That takes the field heat out. By removing the field heat, it doesn't go limp on you. Now, a lot of times you'll see health foods or greens that are wilted by mid-afternoon. They didn't do this simple procedure, simple technique. My great aunt showed me how to do that. She always had this bucket, and the bucket was filled with ice. The moment something came out of the ground, boom, and it went into that bucket of cold water. She says, Gary, Michael, that takes the field heat out, and now that'll last a week instead of an hour. She says, that'll still be crisp. And so we go in and we'd wick them with this little spinner, and same spinner we use for spinning honey. It was kind of fun to see how honey actually comes out of a beehive. You know, you cut the caps off and you put it in this little, on the top of what looks like just a 55-gallon barrel. And then you just have a simple crank and you crank it. And as you crank it, it spins around. As it spins around, centrifugal force causes the honey to come out. And as the honey comes out, it goes slowly down into a sieve and comes out into your jar. But the game a lot of people play is, well, that's a slow process. So what do? They dilute the honey with water. Or with a glucose syrup. Well then what amount of this honey is honey and what of it is fructose? Or what? And a lot of it's coming from China now. In fact, most of it's coming from China and they don't label it as such. So what you got to do is buy organic, raw, unheated honey and make sure it says the type. Because that's a catch if there's no type. Like Tupelo, Orange Blossom, Date Palm. It'll say it on it. Eucalyptus. That means that the bees were going to the eucalyptus plants. Or to the clover. Where you got a big clover field. And they were pollinating the clover. And in return they were making the honey. And that's how it's done. It's a slow process. And those who are humane beekeepers don't really take any honey. You leave the honey for the bees. What you're getting is you're getting fertilization. And that represents 1/3 of all crops in America. And guess who doesn't have bee collapse, hive collapse? We don't. Because A, we're not shipping our bees with stress, and B, we're not using genetically modified seed. 3, we're not using pesticides, and D, there's no electromagnetic pulses from overhead towers that can cause all these disruptive factors. So you get a nice hive, 30, 50, 100,000 bees, and then suddenly everything is growing. Everything's in bloom. That's pollination. So the small stores, they don't need to have anything waxed. Well, who's waxing? Oh, trying to get stuff from New Zealand, South Africa, Chile, Mexico in the wintertime. And so to make sure that however long it takes to get it to market, they put these coatings on it. And then it gets to the general distributor maybe 10 days later. And then it gets distributed into your store, and then it's 15 days later. But it still looks fresh, yeah, because it's got that wax on it. I'd rather know that I'm getting something that is unwaxed, that will go bad in a week or two, that I don't have to ever think about what I'm eating. So there's not just organic, there's the authentic, buy it from local sponsors, and don't have it waxed, small health food stores, then there's the big Whole Foods. And you already know my thoughts on that. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment, then opening up for your calls. This is all about health and healing today, taking our time, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and let's see who can accurately list the 15 or 16 different foods harvested fresh from my orchard. These are all just fruits, by the way. And see if any of you can get it. You can go to GaryKnoll.com or my Facebook page and see if you can get it right. Like, I'd hope that some of you can get it right. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
We'll
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. In a moment, the latest on protecting your eyes. Then, we're going to take a look at programming genes the natural way so that you can live a longer life. But it's time to take some calls. We have a full board right now, so please, no one else call in. We got gazillion calls here. I'm looking at calls from Washington, D.C., California, all over the United States and Canada. Let's start with Kevin from California. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air. Hi, Kevin. Speak up. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Where in California are you?
In Irvine, Orange County.
All right. How can we help you today?
Yes, my question was, I've made many positive changes in my life in the past few years. However, there is still like one area that I have problem with. So I'm a full-time student, and when I sit down to study, I find it difficult to concentrate. And the big problem is that I feel bored. I mean, I love my major, but I'm not getting much done when it comes to studying and when I don't have to. So I do very well during exam seasons because there's that force and motivation. And I get things done very well, but then when stress is not there, I get bored real fast when I have to sit down and study. So, what should I do then to be able to study, let's say, 8 hours a day without?
Right. What is your major?
Bored? Nutrition.
Okay. Let me give you an example. When I was in school, I always was interested in the personality of the instructor. And the most challenging instructor I had was the one that I felt that I learned the most from, because he wasn't teaching us how to pass a course. That was the difference between my generation and your generation. My generation, you were given the basics as tools so that you could function in a constructive way in our society. You were supposed to be motivated, self-motivated enough that you'd want to learn so that you could get out of school and do something with your life. Today, the emphasis is upon how well you're testing. But we know if all you do is study for tests or have tutors or tutorials for testing and different books that show you what kind of questions you're going to get, none of which did we have. When we took a test, we took a test. You know, we knew that we'd be tested on the material we had been given throughout that semester, but at the end of that, we had to do a lot of studying. And I once asked my professor, his name was James Dixon, and I said, what's your suggestion to keep a student's interest in class? And he said, it's not for me to keep your interest. It's for you to come to my class interested in knowing what I have to know. He said, I have information that can help you if you apply it later in life. If you choose not to pay attention in class, then even if you get a good grade, you're going to be ill-prepared for what waits you outside of class. He said, come to class to challenge me. And I did thereafter. So I looked at what I was being taught and asked, is this what I need to know? And if not, what do I need to know in this? So, for example, when I went to dietetics class, I asked a simple question. Why is it if we're supposed to all be eating meat to get our protein 3 times a day, why is it there are people living longer lives, healthier lives, that have little or no meat in the world? Well, that got me thrown out of class. I was thrown out of class 8 times. I was thrown out more than all the other students in the history of that dietetics class. I finally graduated, but at least I knew that the teachers did not know. Later, when I was a scientist at the Institute of Biology, that question kept coming up. So I wondered, how is it that people are not eating meat? They're eating millet in Africa. Millet is called the poor man's protein in millet in Africa. It's kind of a light-tasting, almost an almond-tasting grain. But all the textbooks, including Normal and Therapeutic Nutrition, the official textbook every nutritionist in America uses, said that only animal proteins, including dairy, contain all 8 essential amino acids. Essential meaning you could not create them in your body. You had to get them from exogenous or outside sources. And the best sources were beef, a chicken, a pork, dairy, and fish. And hence, the basic 4 food group in the food pyramid was built around your largest selection were your proteins. Now, that's why we had bacon and eggs for breakfast, or ham and cheese for lunch, or roast beef or pot roast for dinner. We were getting our protein, and of course we had to have milk all 3 times. Only later did I find out that none of this had to do with the science of nutrition. It all had to do with making a profit and having lobbyists in there who got their product group, eggs or beef or chicken, into the basic 4 food group, and they did that through influencing the USDA panel. So when one night at the Institute of Pie Biology, I was doing an amino acid analysis on beans, because beans are universal. All over the world, people eat legumes, pulses, or beans. In India, one of the most commonly used, aside from rice and wheat, is also lentils and split peas. Big users of lentils. I don't know of any other country in the world that uses as many lentils like you would use in a dal soup as in India. So I'm thinking, gee whiz, lots of Indians don't eat any meat. They're for religious reasons, like Hindus, they don't eat meat. Now, Buddhism does not say you have to be a vegetarian. In fact, the Dalai Lama eats meat, as does his physician. But some choose not to eat meat. The Jains don't eat meat. And many people in the Jewish community. In fact, I just finished filming some of the leading rabbis in the world who are vegetarian and or are vegan. And also I just finished filming some leading Christians and Islamic instructors also, even though the religion does not specifically advocate that. In any case, in the morning, I looked at my results and I thought, well, I've made a mistake. I screwed up here somewhere. So I asked a Dr. Berman, who came in after me. I says, Vic, I made a mistake here. Could you just redo this analysis and do this breakdown of the amino acid patterns in brown rice and tell me what they are? So 2 days later, he gives me the paper and I look at it and I said, well, nuts, he made a mistake too, because they're equal to what I did. And then I said, we must have been using the same flawed methodology. Could you do it again, but go directly to the biochemistry book, use the exact methodology for determining this? He did, and he came back. It was still the same. Now, here I'm stuck in a paradigm, one of those moments, where official science, all of it, official nutrition, 100% of it, all of dietetics, and I was at that point, of course, a registered dietitian. I was a PhD in human nutrition. All of it says only animal proteins give you all 8 essential amino acids. The grains and legumes give you incomplete amino acids, and fruits and vegetables give you very incomplete amino acids. So the idea was, if you go doing something stupid like being a vegan, you really are going to injure your health. And so people were afraid of doing this. Well, then I realized, what if they're wrong? So I went to the director of the institute, and I said, what happens when you find out that everyone in the entire world of science is wrong? He said, well, that's highly improbable, but if that ever should happen, then you create a new paradigm. But it will not be accepted, because for you to be right about anything means everyone else to be wrong, and that means everything that they have based that wrongness on, their reputation, their funding, their position within society, their position of being considered an authority, all that would in turn be challenged. I said, could we convene a meeting of all the scientists here? There were 17 different departments, and all the different scientists came the following Monday. And I got up and I made a presentation. I said, it is my belief with this methodology used, which is standard methodologies, that we were able to find all 8 essential amino acids in non-animal sources. We found it in 10 separate items, including in fruits and vegetables. One guy said, but that's not possible. I said, you're absolutely right. And then I said, but it wasn't possible for any human being, according to all the scientists in the world, to break a 4-minute mile. Then Bannister broke a 4-minute mile, and shortly thereafter, about 10 other people did. So I said, I'm merely asking, would you all look at my work and determine, is there any flaw in my work? I said, the director of the Institute long ago told me that any time I make a discovery, disprove myself, tear myself apart. And I've tried to do that. I've had other people in to do that, and we all come to the same conclusion. And what was interesting to me was that nobody wanted to do it. As a result, I spent another year and a half on that project, and I tested almost 150 different foods. And then a Dr. Hillard Fitzke, I believe from Columbia, came in. I gave him the results, and he computerized it all. And what he found was that by taking vegetables, legumes, and grains and beans, in different combinations and normal serving sizes, you actually had a better profile, more perfect profile of protein to be used in the body than from any meat source. In fact, there were 5,000 combinations better than meat. And more importantly, we exceeded the net protein utilization of the egg, which was considered the most perfect form of protein utilization. So we literally turned science of nutrition upside down and kicked it out the door. I remember one of our listeners, when I was mentioning this, and I called this the Egg Project, worked at the UN, and she came over and she took a look at all of our results, and at this point they were irrefutable. I mean, we had the science on our side, but we had nothing else on our side. We had the truth and nothing else. And that was such a lesson for me, because I saw in a glaring way that even if you have absolute proof that what someone is doing is wrong, they will not change. And indeed, to this day, nothing's changed. And she says, you realize that when we implement this through the UN, it can save hundreds of millions of lives. I said, how so? She says, right now we're giving non-fat dry milk to Africans, and they in turn are giving it to their babies and their water. These babies are dying of diarrhea because they have lactose intolerance, or they're having severe allergies, gastrointestinal allergies to the dairy, and that is killing them in astronomical numbers. But instead of looking at the fact we're actually killing these people because it's free food, and we're also giving the Mormons stored cheese that is stored out in abundance there, we're giving that to Africa, we're actually hurting these people. This way you can go in there, and I'll see that you go over there, and you can show them which specific grains to plant, and try to select those that are arid resistance, meaning those that don't require a lot of water, so that they can plant the ones they need. So when they harvest, they eat them all together in a bread or a porridge, and they're going to have much better nutrition. Great idea. And then it hit the reality of a very corrupt, bureaucratic, technocratic UN. And then in came all the people from the food industries, $200 billion years. And they said, you're not going to allow this to happen, and it never happened. It took 12 years before that article was finally accepted into a peer-reviewed journal. And along the way, one of the scientists at one of the mainstream scientific journals who rejected it had written in the margins, and you never get your article back. You get a rejection letter, but they don't tell you why. But this someone actually sent me back the article. And here are all these guys, this top scientist at this major university, here's his little comments. This can't be. Well, this is impossible. Well, but it was possible. We gave them all the science, all the graphs. Now imagine how many diseases are caused by animal proteins. Colorectal cancer, bladder cancer, breast cancer. Think of all the hormone-disrupting chemicals in dairy and beef. Think of how much land is used and how many calories we feed a cow to get a calorie in return. 16 to 1. 16 pounds of beef, grains you feed to a cow to get 1 pound return. How much water does it take to grow a potato? 60 gallons. how much water does it take to create a pound of beef? 1,200. So, a whole lot wrong, but my goodness, you really have to understand the truth is almost never accepted anywhere, under any circumstance, if it challenges the existing official positions. That was just a little thing that I wanted to share with you out there, Kevin, in California. Because now, when you go into a class and you're sitting there...
Yes, Gary.
It's your responsibility to honor the fact that for a period of time in your life, you're being given the same advantage of a student of Socrates to sit in the presence of Socrates, a teacher, I'm using this as a metaphor, where you're going to gain some sacred knowledge. You will then challenge that knowledge. You will challenge it intellectually. You will challenge it practically. You will challenge it so you can see, is this biased material, accurate material, inaccurate material, applicable material? Can I use this? This is something good. If it's not, challenge the instructor. If it is, thank them. And then look forward to the next day when your mind will expand and that information will be what you need to help the person. Because if the object of the exercise is for you, Kevin, to help another human being make a better choice in life, to help them if they have a problem, then how in the world can you help anyone if you're intellectually lazy and don't care about keeping your focus? Then how in the world are you going to help anyone later? Because you'll be just as equally lazy when it comes to being like so many other people. You become a typical dietitian or nutritionist that uses a recipe. Well, according to this, take this. But what if I'm not like everyone else? Well, I don't have the time for it. I'm not interested. It's boring me. Do you understand? It's all about you becoming mindful of the moment you're in and disconnect from the power of those subconscious tapes and unconscious tapes to make you think that you need something to distract you, to excite you, to entertain you, to interest you, for you to commit yourself to it. That's the narcissistic selfishness of an entire generation. Get over it, and otherwise, could you imagine someone treating you if you were sick and not looking at you as if you were the most interesting problem in the world that they were going to do everything possible to help? How would you feel if someone says, well, look, on a scale of 1 to 100, I'm going to give you 10% of my energy and attention because, quite frankly, today I'm bored. I want to be someplace else doing something else and talking with someone else. But you're here and you're paying me, so I'm going to give you 10% of my energy. And you say, but I have terminal cancer. I know you've got terminal cancer, and maybe I could, if I really cared, maybe I could work hard enough to find out what you need and help you. But today it's not in my mindset. How would you feel, Kevin?
I wouldn't like it.
Okay.
For sure.
All right. So why don't you now begin to commit yourself that whatever you do, do mindfully and do at the highest level of your spiritual capacity. And then do that with everything else in your life. Everything you do from this moment forward, Kevin, do that if you died tomorrow, you could say, look at my life for what I just did. I'm willing to be judged upon it because I do nothing unconsciously. Okay?
Okay, thank you so much.
All the best to you, Kevin. I'm looking at the clock and we're out of time. And I thank you all for taking your time to listen in. And we'll get to everything else we didn't get to on an upcoming program. I don't like to rush anything. I'd rather take the time so we have a beginning, middle, and end to the context of an issue. I'm Gary Knoll. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now, Michael Rupert, here on the number one listen progressive radio station in the world, growing by numbers that are almost unfathomable, is Michael Rupert. Hi, Michael. Do we have Michael there?
I really enjoyed listening to you because what you were talking about science refusing to even accept peer-reviewed stuff when it's stuck in their faces, of course applies to people like me and my guest tonight, Michelle Chosudowski of the Center for Research on Globalization. We've thrown the political proof or the legal proof in people's faces for years, and we paid a price for that too. But the worm is changing for all of us, and that's some good news tonight. We also have some good news about standing down from the attack on Iran. It looks like it's too much for the U.S. to handle. Yay.
Good. Well, Michael, by the way, our latest figures showed that we just picked up 747,000 new listeners. That's more than NPR or Fox or any other station did in the same period of time. So congratulations, you're a part of that. All the people on PRN are a part of that. We are growing by leaps and bounds, and we have 15 new programs beginning in the next 4 weeks. Some very exciting things, so we look forward now to spending an hour with you. All the best in your hour.
Thanks, Gary.
Back in a moment with Michael Rupert.